Oh, yeah. It is Wednesday, April 17th, a little bit after 5 p.m. Central. And you know what that means. It's time for Tasty Live's all-new evening show, The Price of Truth, a show where we explore the incentives that govern our world. Some have called it the most public show on the internet. But the idea is to have great minds come on and share great ideas. We could pull up symbol by symbol and say, sell the 16 Delta straddle. Pull up a new symbol, say, sell the 16 Delta straddle. Pull up a new symbol, say, sell the 16 Delta straddle. But we kind of figure you're a little bit more intelligent than that, and you want a bit nuanced discussion. And the fact that we have a decent audience on a day-over-day basis seems to prove that. I'm venting right now. Today we have the global. I forgot this is supposed to be an intro. Today we have the global head of macro at Tasty Live, Mr. Ilya Spivak. Ilya, it's a pleasure and honor to be able to talk to you for the third time this week, my friend. How you doing?
Good, good. I love this show. So that what we're going to be doing this regularly is definitely something I'm very happy about. I'm also not mad at all at these markets, which are doing the thing I've been banging my fist on the table about for weeks and weeks.
Yeah, I got kind of lucky too. On Sunday, you and I had a conversation. You were playing it short. I think Tom was playing it short. I said I wanted to see a Monday rally first before playing it short. We got that. I also said I thought it would be a weak week for metals. So I had some gold puts on that I actually increased. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. And then the other thing I said is I wanted to see if metals were weak, what does that mean for a Chinese stock? And you saw what looked like some short covering. I want to talk about all that and much more, my friend. First and foremost, just give me your thoughts on broad-based indices. NASDAQ, of course, is fairly weak here today. What was your thought on equity market action here today?
Well, I think there was an opportunity this week, especially like, let's say on Tuesday in today's session, to say if the sell-off on Friday and Monday was about geopolitics, if that was really the explanation. And I said on Friday, I didn't think that was the main thing. There was, of course, some geopolitics sprinkled in there. Sure, I'll buy that. But if that was the story, if this was, oh no, Iran's going to attack Israel, oh look, there they go. If that was that, there was an opportunity on Monday, on Tuesday, let's say more so on Tuesday and maybe even today, to say, oh good, the cycle of escalation seems to be concluded. Iran made their move. They telegraphed it for weeks. Everything was intercepted. For the most part, no harm, no foul. Iran issued a prompt statement saying, we're done. We're not looking to do anything else. This is it. And earlier today, we got a word from Jerusalem saying, we, of course, reserve the right to self-defense, and we're going to attack Iran somehow, some way, at some stage. But we don't need to be in a hurry. We are looking at a big, broad strategy, lots of ins, lots of outs, lots of what have yous that essentially left it at, we're going to get you at some point at some time.
Yeah, whoever planned that that scripted performance over the weekend, I want to play poker with them. Because if the idea was to make that look like a very organic, like...
No.
Looking at that goes, what the hell is this?
And I think that was the point. Yeah. I think what Iran really wanted to say there was, we are not going to wade into this thing. Leave us out of it. We are going to continue to operate in our sort of proxy kind of way. We are not looking for a direct confrontation.
Today was a bit different, though. So you had a bit of, all sectors weren't lower. So there were two things different about today. First thing that was different is you had some sectors positive. Now, granted, it's all the defensive sectors like utilities and like staples, but you also had financials and materials, which had rallied as well.
Yep.
The second thing, which was a bit different, is by the end of the day, you actually got vol selling. You got a bit of vol contraction into the end of the session. And so you didn't have this sort of correlation goes to one, all things move as one trade.
Right.
You had some sense of dispersion today. Again, accounting for the fact that where you did see money moving was defensive in nature. You also saw bonds, while they did rally like half a point, 16 ticks-ish, they got stuck and they didn't move from that point after sort of early morning. So, you know, I took some of the my short futures off. I established some additional downside long put spreads in the NASDAQ just in case we keep rolling. But I didn't like how much like short future delta I had on, just given the fact that we just kind of got stuck. We kept pressing like down 1.33% was the bottom. We pressed it again later in the session. Didn't seem to want to go anywhere. How do you read that sort of market action? You take anything from today with the fact that you actually did see money coming in, deployed, you saw vol contract? What do you read from that?
So I think this all kind of fits together. So if you thought that this was about geopolitics and geopolitics only, we had an opportunity to rally stocks Tuesday, Wednesday.
I think Monday showed right away this was not a geopolitical story.
And I think you saw. I think you saw, right? That's not it. Today, you got the Israeli side of it really kind of closing the circle.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I think you look at this, and I mean, crude oil cracked hard, which sort of reinforces that idea.
Yep.
And then you look at this and you say, okay, so then if you don't have the kind of rabid risk on risk off dynamic here and equities still can't go up, and you do have some vol contraction, you do have a little bit more of a hodgepodge as far as sectors. It's not just dollar bonds, other anti-risk up, everything risk down. I think what that says is that equity markets want to keep going lower here, and that what this is much more the kind of a narrative that I've been talking about for weeks and weeks and weeks. Basically, as soon as the NASDAQ reached a point of stopping, where, let's call it 6 weeks ago now, where it essentially said, okay, if the motivation behind this rally, specifically in the big equity indices, if the motivation since late October, early November has been, there's tons of risks, but, right? And there's, I mean, all manner of assorted risks. We don't know what the cumulative tightening is going to do. There's two wars. There's China that can't get off the mat, and it's the world's second largest economy. What does that mean? Europe is anemic. What does that mean? The only real game in town is U.S. growth, and we still don't know what all this tightening will invariably do. So lots of risks. But if you're not afraid of the risks because future money is going to be cheaper to borrow than it is now, okay, worst case, I'll take a bet, I'll take a loss. That's encouraging of appetite for risk. And that story stayed with us really the entire length of this rally until March 21st, which is the first day where that was no longer the case.
Mm-hmm. When do you think, because sort of in a normal curve, mm-hmm. money in the future should be more expensive. So
yes.
In the world we came from, that was sort of, we are in a very weird situation, but we're starting to normalize. So my question to you is,
mm-hmm.
your perception is currently money that's more expensive in the future is leading to risk off. I just want to explore devil's advocate here.
Of course.
At what point does the market normalize out of that, and we start to say money that's more expensive in the future is what it's supposed to look like that? We've destroyed the extra leverage. We now have a situation where we have a normal yield curve, potentially. Banks can make money again. They can extend private mm-hmm. credit to the private markets. At what point does money more expensive in the future turn from a risk-off measure for Ilya Spivak to just the normal cost of doing business and duration?
Right. So if money is more expensive in the future because of duration, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
If what you're talking about, and that's, of course, what we're saying here, is short term money. That that is the floor upon which duration is built. If that itself is moving, right, that then extrapolates across durations with various degree, right? As you get, let's say, the spread between the 30 and the 10, there's not that much differentiation there as, let's say, between the 2 and the 10, right? There's a much bigger gap there. That's why the yield curve tends to go up more steeply in the front and less steeply in the back end. So, because obviously you get paid for duration. Why? Because lots more can go wrong in 10 years than 2 years, but you don't get that much better of a view of what can go wrong between 10 years and 30 years. It's all a black box at that point. So what we're talking about here in terms of money gets more expensive is the floor. Is the floor moving? And right now the floor is moving. Mm-hmm. And what's happened since the beginning of the year is the floor has moved in a way that the market now thinks that the money is going to cost more than what the Fed is saying. And that's really the key, is what's your benchmark? What's your baseline? The baseline that the Fed gave us on March the 20th is, okay, yeah, hotter data, whatever, whatever. And Powell said this at the press conference. He said, we upgraded growth and inflation based on data that's already out.
Mm-hmm.
As if to say, we don't expect it to continue. And that's why we kept it at 3 cuts. Now, you're in a situation where the market is at, okay, maybe it's like 1 cut and 50-50 on a second. Fed doesn't talk again until May 1st, if memory serves, is the next meeting.
Thank God.
So, I mean, they'll talk. They won't say anything official.
Shut those people up. Somebody lock them in the basement somewhere and duct tape their mouths closed.
And they won't revise official forecast until June. So, you know, there's legs here.
Mm-hmm.
I think you get to something more normal again when the Fed and markets realign and the object of speculation goes away.
Mm.
So now, like, why did it make sense to speculate risk on? Because the Fed and the markets were disconnected. Mm-hmm. The markets were saying the Fed's wrong. Now they're saying the Fed's wrong. It's just the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
The markets were saying 3 cuts, 6. And then the data comes out and they're like, okay, 5.
Right.
Data keeps getting better. Like, okay, 4.
Right.
It's just a little more expensive. It's still good. And then you get to 3 and markets go, wait a second. And the NASDAQ stops and basically sits there all of March and does nothing. And then the moment it goes from now we're not at parity, now the Fed is wrong because they're too dovish, everything collapses.
Let me ask you, it seems like I'm a little bit less, some part of me is thinking like maybe this market trades a bit choppy here for the rest of this week. It just didn't seem for as weak as this rollover was, and maybe that's the net, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're just rolling them by 1% a day, that's enough for everybody to be super confident and come in and say, you know what, I'm buying this dip. down 8%.
Steam roll them again, baby.
But I do think like I feel less confident about, you know, continuing to roll the rest of the week, just given some of the signals we saw at the end of the day, that contraction, that money was being deployed, even if it was defensive, it wasn't all things go to one. So anyways,
I don't think that is number one out of scope of reason, because you're kind of out of big catalysts here.
So my question to you, My question to you is, what are you looking for? Like, are you looking for a number? Are you looking like a level? Are you looking for a valuation? Are you looking for a divergence between, some intermarket or intramarket divergence? Mm-hmm. What exactly are you looking for? Because you went into this with risk off mentality. Are you effectively just looking for the Fed and markets on short-term rates to for that gap to come in? I mean, in many ways, the market has already pushed out cut expectations from June, July to basically September is where they're at right now, give or take. Like, what are you looking for?
Sure. So I think for me, at the end of the day, everything comes down to the price action, and there is no knowing how the market will interpret this or that fundamental thing other than looking at what the market is actually doing to interpret it. So if you look at, let's say, a daily chart on ES, what you see is a clear series of lower highs and lower lows since we hit a top. And so for me, if you go to a one-day chart,
there we go.
Yeah, you can very clearly see, like, we're making lower lows. And at this point, we seem to be clearing out levels where this has been sticky before. So 5,200 was a place where things were sticky before. We've taken that out. Now we're seemingly taking out this area around like 5,035, 5,050 that was sticky before. We paused there yesterday. We cleared it out today. The next level seems to be right under 5,000, maybe something like 4,950. What I'm looking for here is for this sequence of lower highs and lower lows to be violated. And I think where you look at that, where you get an example of this, is in the euro today. So I've been short the euro from about 108, the latest one. I've been short the euro essentially all year and like trying to pick spots. The latest one that I put on was at about 108.30, 108.25 on 6E. And what you saw today, especially if you look at a 4-hour chart, an 8-hour chart, a daily chart, is what you did was make a higher high for the first time in this latest leg of the down move. And so I said, okay, maybe this thing wants to bounce. I'm going to take my money. I'll get back in. Sure. Get me back up to 107. And maybe I'll look to get back in. But when the price action is telling me, hey, I'm exhausted, okay, I'll take my ball and I'll back up. But that doesn't change my macro view. It changes the tactical manifestation of what I'm doing with that view.
Let me go outside of equities for just a second. Did you have a long bond? Were you long bonds?
I have a little bit on at the front end. So I have the SHY ETF on.
That's right.
And I did it through the ETF because I didn't want to roll futures or roll option spreads, because obviously the Fed, when to cut, how to cut, is the active object of speculation. And so I just wanted a little bit of exposure that said they're going to cut at some stage here. So let me just buy a little of the front end, and I'll just have it.
I see.
I don't want to worry about leverage. I don't want to worry about rolling. I'm just going to have a little. And so I have that. I've had it basically since SHY was at 80, and it's give or take just a hair above that now. So it's had a nice ride. I'm going to have it in the background. I don't have anything that's more kind of tactical on yet, although I'm looking at the long end with hungry eyes and looking at it and going, this is going to be a bottom here somewhere if this risk aversion continues, and I want to be a buyer of it.
Yeah, I'm sort of concerned. It might take some time. I'm also long the back.
It might take some time.
Yeah, I'm long very small futures in the notes and Forsyth ZN, but I have some downside puts against it. So it's a synthetic position, really. But I have more puts just in case it gets ugly, that it allows me to stay in the long bond position for a little bit, to be hedged and stay in it for a little bit longer.
Interesting thing on that, actually. And I were talking about this earlier in the week, talking about how the bonds on Friday were very kind of classic risk off bonds. Right. And then stocks kept falling and the bonds didn't really follow through in the same way. And I had this thought of like, maybe the term premium in the bonds is starting to swell because of greater uncertainty about rates. And that's giving them this like weird shading that has nothing to do with Fed policy or risk dynamics. It's just more uncertainty. And indeed, I looked up the term premium on the 10-year zero coupon note, and it's at the highest since, you're going to love this, November. What do we know happened in November? So it's at the highest since then. So it looks like there's a sense that that maybe that's shading it. And until that gets worked out, which in my mind is the market and the Fed, again, come in line, and you start to understand like, okay, policy is back to something that everybody feels is on a course to a destination that seems like everybody knows, that then gives the bond market more of its sort of more normal dynamics again.
You know, I was reading Twitter because it is called Twitter, and Google's called Google, and Square is called Square, and I'm not going to play.
You're not going to get any argument from me.
I'm playing these stupid games because you hired some marketing executive, and they needed to plant the flag somehow, and their big brilliant idea was to just come
you
up.
You sold
with
me
a new
the brand
logo.
Already. I bought it already.
It's called a new logo and a new brand, so they could make their, you know, their salary look like they're worth the money. Anyway, sorry for the aside. The point is, I was reading Twitter. that was my point. I'm reading Twitter, and I realized a guy named Andy. So again, I told you I was like sort of leaning short, but when I say that, it's sort of a I'm short gold, but I still have some minor exposure. So I have more minors than gold exposures, just to be very careful. Andy Constan said on Twitter he was taking a short position in gold. And I think it was on Monday.
That's a good endorsement.
I think it was on Monday. Michael Kao said something to the same extent. So I'm kind of curious. I don't know if you have a explicit position. I'm sure you have an opinion because we all have one. But do you have an explicit opinion on everybody's favorite pet rock here at 2400?
So I don't have a position on. Let's start with that.
Okay.
The reason I don't have a position on is I look at gold as historically a foil for the dollar and a foil for real yields and real yields more specifically, because gold is not an asset that yields anything. And so if interest rates are going up, you'd expect gold to be relatively less attractive. If the dollar is going up, you would expect gold to be relatively less attractive. Where it typically gets its momentum is when the dollar and yields are going in the same direction, which is how, for example, in 2022, for all the whole year, everybody was screaming, well, stocks are going down. Isn't gold a safe haven? Why is it also falling? Because it's not a safe haven. Because that's ludicrous. Because it moves with yields. And if yields are going up and that's why stocks are falling, then gold is going to fall with stocks because yields are going up and the dollar is going up. So it was a very clear kind of thing. This latest gold rally, let's say from March, from that little congestive area in March where it takes out its spike high from last year and goes on this latest big run, has been disconnected from those dynamics. And as I've posited on this show, the only thing that seems to be different that lines up is this very aggressive speed of Chinese reserve accumulation. And so that immediately is a red flag.
And Costco customer accumulation. Don't
them
forget
too.
That.
Them too. Them too. But the volumes are just.
I know, I'm joking.
Huge. Huge. No, Costco customers don't generate a small volume.
Where are you headed? I'm going to Costco. What are you picking up? I'm picking up I'm picking up $1.50 hot dog and a kilogram of fucking gold. Okay.
Our mutual friend Charts Dubrovsky made the crack on Twitter the other day that after I was talking about that inflation conversation we were having the other day, saying the Costco hot dog, the thing immune to inflation, $1.50 since the 1980s.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what's in it.
Right. Probably best not to think about it.
Probably.
But as I look at gold here, I'm tempted to be a seller. But also...
Come on in, baby. Water's fine. The more of you I get, the more likely this trade is going to work. unless China goes, let's go get some more.
That's the thing. So I'm tempted to be a seller, but anytime you have bottomless pocket buyers in the market, I go, it's tough to fight. Mm. So for me, it sort of looks like this. The sequencing kind of looks like this. Next Fed meeting is June, where they actually change the forecast. Like, they'll say stuff in May, but the next one that resets the baseline, right? This whole conversation of, is the money cheaper in the future, more expensive? That's against the baseline. The March Fed baseline is 3 cuts. We're now less than that, yada, yada. The next time they reset the baseline is June. If things keep evolving the way they're evolving now, and we've heard it from Powell now this week, he came out yesterday and said, yeah, about the cuts. I don't know. He just said this yesterday. So you get a revision in the baseline. Let's say they go down to 2 cuts. Let's say they go down to 1, whatever it is. They reset the baseline to something more hawkish, gold's going to get smacked. And if it gets smacked, I might be interested in being a buyer lower, more so than being a seller here. Because if I think I think China is going to be accumulating, and I did the math on this, there are about, give or take, at a pace that they're going, which is 11% year on year, which is nuts. Mm-hmm. And ostensibly, that was the fourth quarter of last year. They're probably going faster now, looking at the price action here. Mm-hmm. If the goal is, let's say, in my mind, it's not to obviously replace the dollar because they can't. Their biggest export market is still the U.S. plus the Eurozone, which operates within a USD-settled SWIFT way of transacting. So they can't get off the dollar. But what they can do is have a parallel to SWIFT that is, let's say, having its trade settlement with countries like Russia. Mm. Backed by gold, and they can say, hey, if you're France, come on in. You too can transact inside here. It's backed by gold. It's not just the yuan and you have to take our word for it. They can make that statement to India. They can make that statement to other countries and say, look, we're not saying we're going to stop transacting in dollars. That's impossible. We don't have an economy if we stop transacting in dollars. We need to sell to the West. But we can also have this system where you can transact in a gold-backed way with those countries that are cut out of the dollar world, like Russia. If that's what they want to do and you want to guesstimate what that looks like as far as how long they have to keep going, they're at about $135 billion, and their trade with Russia was about $240 billion last year. If they want to get to 240 on reserves at a pace of 11% year on year, this goes through the first quarter of next year. And if they're going faster, then maybe not as much. But my suspicion is it's got legs. So if the Fed smacks this down hard and we get to 2,200, 2,300, something like that, maybe. We'll see where it is. But if the Fed smacks this because they revise their perspective, I might be interested in saying, let me ride the train with China here if they're going to turn their bottomless pockets on this. And instead ride the upswing off whatever fall, rather than attempt to pick this top.
That's a really interesting insight, my friend. I appreciate you sharing it. I appreciate the work you did to earth it as well. A couple people in the chat, shout out to everybody in the YouTube chat. Do us a favor, hit the like button if you're watching. You appreciate the content so far. But they talked just a little bit about, you know, at the very beginning of this gold rally, the sort of the word was, you don't know if you can trust it. Why do you not know if you can trust it? Because the miners aren't rallying. This is the narrative. Right. Not saying it makes any sense. But this is the narrative that you don't give the miners the credit for what they're taking out of the ground because it had a short-term rally, which I sort of understand. So the miners rallied with a pretty big lag, but they did rally. And so we had Peter Buchvar on and a few others who were fairly bullish on the miners. And it's been a nice little rip here. Newmont Mining has rallied from like 30 up to 40 bucks. But the point is they're starting to confirm this move, this higher leg up. And higher prices for a longer period of time, as you're sort of insinuating with this rally in the miners as well. Can I talk to you about the digital gold here for a second? Because you and I haven't talked about digital gold in a really long time. Talking about Bitcoin, it's gone from 71. It's now down at 61, which is always funny. I'm no hater on Bitcoin, by the way. I don't give a shit. I don't care. The point is, if it's a volatility instrument or if it's your the way you're going to save yourself, your purchasing power over currency debasement, whatever your narrative is, I respect it.
It's a trade like any other.
That's the way I think about it. The point is, when Bitcoin's like at 60, like when you get these downtrends, it's so funny. And this thing's rallying. You hear it every damn day, especially on social media. You know, everyone's tweeting out the number. If it hits around number like 63,
it's got a culty 65 element in it.
And then all of a sudden you get for a week or so, this thing going from 71 to 61 is crickets. Nobody's saying a damn word. But Bitcoin at 61.5, man, do you have a directional opinion here? Do you think this is an interesting area to step in? I'm guessing because you're risk off, you're not necessarily thinking about the highest beta risk as something you want as an interesting level here, but it's worth asking the question anyway.
No, I think that's exactly right. So you've just hit the nail right on the head. I mean, I look at this as a risky asset in a world where the market seems not to like melt up risky assets. And so if the story, like to me, Bitcoin isn't a competitor to currencies. Like this idea that Bitcoin is somehow going to displace fiat currencies is a competitor to the dollar. I mean, I've thought that was ludicrous from day one, and nothing that's happened since this thing came out in the wake of the 08 crisis has changed that perspective.
By the way, Ilya apparently wants all the smoke. So if you're watching this and you're Bitcoin maxi, whatever the case is, go in the comments, my friend, because Ilya does get in there and respond. So give
us
your thoughts.
I'll have this debate all day. I don't think it's money. I don't think that is in any way a knock to Bitcoin or the technology. I think the technology is going to be instrumental and is a giant breakthrough and is very important. I don't think the individual tokens themselves, Bitcoin as a token, as a unit of a thing, is going to replace the dollar or fiat money or anything of the sort. In fact, I think the technology is going to be used to make those fiat currencies that much more powerful with the advent of a digital dollar, a digital euro, et cetera.
Hell no, man.
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be, and that's why I think what this technology is disruptive of banks, let's say.
I'll get out there with a pitchfork if somebody tries to tell me I got to use a CBDC in the future.
Oh, I think
pitchfork.
I think we're definitely going there. I think we're probably there already, and it's silly to think that we're not, because all of our money are digits in a computer already.
Yeah, they can just hot swap the back end. I would never even know.
Yeah, all of our money is digits in a computer already.
Not me, baby. Straight cash, homie. I got cash in the walls over here, baby boy.
The only difference.
Don't know how I roll.
Right, but you're going to have to spend it some way, and then it just becomes zeros again. It just becomes ones and zeros again. But the most important thing is that this will eventually, I think the technology, not the token, is going to be a disruptor for institutions that depend on us having money with them in order to survive, like banks, and that charge us a VIG to do our transacting. Well, if the government is able to do all that they do in a scalable way and charge us nothing, those institutions are going to have to figure out a way to keep our money there, or they don't exist. And so things that before were high net worth things are going to start to become mass market things, like wealth planning, tax advice, all of that. But that's neither here nor there. That's sort of where I'm coming from to the Bitcoin discussion. I think the launch of the ETFs almost completely locks that in, because what it solves is the volatility issue, and it solves it by saying this thing is not money, it's a tradable asset.
And so I want no part of that smoke from the Bitcoin maxis, but the guys in the chat, shout out to, who's the one who said it? I think, was it Nick? No, Joseph. Shout out to Joseph, who just made me aware. I had no idea. I don't mind being honest. Sometimes you miss these things. BITO now has listed options. I had no idea, and now I've got
so
much.
I didn't know either, actually.
I can just dive in here and look at these SKUs for this 22-hour flight. That's all I get to do.
Well, there you go.
For like the next 22 hours. Thank you. Well, so, I appreciate it, Joseph.
In that spirit, right, the ETFs have made Bitcoin into essentially just a risky asset, just another risky asset, another, not risky as in more risk of loss, although you could have that conversation. It's just a different conversation. Mm-hmm. It's more like stocks are a risky asset, as in they are an asset that relies on risk appetite as relative to cash or bonds. Bitcoin is just now another thing on the spectrum. And so if I'm looking at this and saying the market is wary of the cost of capital in the event that they lose money, and so they want to go to safer assets and to cash, which is what we've seen, that's not an environment in which I want to be long Bitcoin. Show me a place where that story ends, and I consider it along the lines of also going long the Qs, let's say. Also,
I'll give you a use case.
The dollar.
I'll give you a use case.
Sure.
So what do you think happens to Bitcoin on a cut? You think it depends what happens on the long end, or do you think there's an immediate sort of move there? Or do you think that's a sell the news event? Like, what do you
that
think
depends
happens
on how
a
much it depends on how telegraphed. See, there you go. You just hit it. Sell the news, right? It depends on how telegraphed the cut is. If you get a one-off cut, and the messaging then is, this is a one and done, we're not going to give you anymore, And the Fed is not in the business of surprising markets by a lot. They don't want crazy volatility. So if they really telegraph the cut, and then the messaging around it is one and done, that's bad news for shares. It's bad news for Bitcoin. It's bad news for risk. But if they come out and say, this cutting cycle is on, we're going, that's bad for dollars. And it's bad for dollar, for anti-dollars, for dollar alternatives. And it pushes people out the risk spectrum. So it's good for stocks. It's good for Bitcoin. It depends. If the story again becomes the Fed is going to start to take the floor on the cost of money and move it lower in earnest, and there's legs there, and there's room to speculate on maybe they'll go further, maybe they'll do more, it's got legs.
Yeah, the markets are kind of wide here in these Bitcoin ETF options.
Not surprising.
But to be honest, I'll take it. Something here is better than nothing, and maybe 15 cents wide at the money on a on something priced at 30. Not great, but it's not the worst I've ever seen either.
Well, and we're after hours here. So maybe these things look this way because that's where they got locked up at the close. But maybe if you look at it at like noon Eastern, they look a little bit better.
Maybe. What do you think? Crude oil came in today. Pretty nasty little move here. There's a build in inventories in the EIA petroleum status report. Obviously, geopolitical tensions cooling, all of that sort of did a number on crude oil moving lower. Do you have an opinion? Do you have an opinion here on what level are you short? I think you're flat crude oil.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't have a position. I did a whole long spiel about this on Macro Money a couple weeks back, where I essentially said, look, that oil is going up here since the beginning of the year is fear of fear itself. Because the supply demand dynamics don't make sense. The U.S. is awash in crude. Like, it's literally swimming in crude. We hit record all-time production at the end of last year. 13.5 million barrels a day. And by the way, we did that with the number of rigs in operation falling, with the number of fracking rigs in operation falling. So not only are we hitting record numbers, we're getting more efficient. We're becoming better at extracting more with less. So that tells me if our consumption is about 20 million barrels a day, we're at 13.5, and storage is only about 60% full. So we still have lots of storage capacity. If we had to go full self-sufficient in a hurry, we could do it very fast. We just turn some more rigs on. And fracking rigs are not difficult to put back online. Traditional rigs, you mothball them. It takes months and months to turn them back on. Fracking, no. You can do it pretty fast. So when you look at that and you say, okay, our exports have been soaring. Our imports are flat. Okay, so let's export a little less and turn a couple fracking rigs back on. We're at 20 million barrels a day in a heartbeat. This is not something that is a supply constraint. When you look at the spread between WTI and Brent crude, the European benchmark, it's been locked around $5 in a relatively tight range since 2013. If there was any disruption from the war in Ukraine, from the Red Sea shenanigans around the Israel-Hamas-Houthi thing, that would be widening, because that's all about shipments of crude through the Red Sea, into the Suez, into the Mediterranean, into Europe. European crude would be a lot more expensive. That spread would widen significantly if there was real disruption. It's not doing it. It's not there. So this is all built on hypothetical what-if kind of fear. And if that hypothetical what if kind of fear is going away, this doesn't have very much to stand on. So I've been kind of hands off on it. It's finally turned. I think right now the risk reward is off because you're sitting right at support. You're right at the former swing high here. So right there, you're basically right sitting on it. I wouldn't sell it here just because the risk reward is off. But if the prices got a little bit more attractive, either with a bounce to 84 or a push maybe through like 78 to give us the next big open wide area in this, I could be convinced.
Did the Biden administration say they were going to start selling some more of the SPR?
I didn't hear that. I mean, that doesn't mean that they didn't say it. I just didn't hear it.
I could have swore earlier this week I read that, but maybe I'm crazy and I don't see an article.
The SPR is such a small amount of oil. Like, there's so little in the SPR. Not because, like, it's not all the way full. There's just the SPR itself at 100% capacity of SPR. It's such a little bit of oil in the grand scheme of things.
Helps me sleep better at night knowing that thing's full.
Like, releasing more or less is kind of like, ah.
I'll tell you that much. I sleep a lot better at night knowing what the
drop in the ocean.
If that thing's full or empty.
It's a drop in the ocean. But the U.S. has so much crude and so much capacity to have crude that we basically never have to worry about it.
I'll bring up one more topic and we'll go out on this one. Just, you know, because I'm really curious. This is another sign that we're sort of still in a market of idiosyncrasies or effectively dispersion. We're not at this correlations going to one.
I would agree with that.
Risk off market yet. I'm not saying it can't come, but that doesn't seem to be how the market's reacting.
I'm with you there.
United had a pretty big spike here to 13%, again, showing sort of the bifurcation of the economy.
Yeah.
You know, there's a ton of money in the, you know, in the upper end and asset owner part of the economy, and traveling's been relatively strong. They totally bested market expectations. Do you think this is likely a theme for the earnings season, that we're likely going to see a lot of dispersion? Those that have a little bit more exposure to, let's say, the luxury brands or upper end consumers, you know, you could see things like this, and you could see the exact opposite. But at the end of the day, to me, it wouldn't surprise me if we don't get a clear theme about the consumer, some clear read through that says, hey, everybody, the consumer spending, or hey, everybody, they're really pulling back. To me, I think it's much more likely that, given the bifurcated nature of the economy, the spending has versus the spending have nots, luxury consumer versus the lower end consumer, I think it's very likely you get a very convoluted and complicated message about the consumer that doesn't have a clear narrative. And I think you get more questions out of this earnings season than answers.
I wouldn't be surprised. I think if you look at the most recent things we've seen out of the consumer has been becoming increasingly happy for quite a while now. And that makes sense. If you look
how are you measuring that, if you don't mind me asking? How do you qualify that statement?
You can look at a number of things. My favorite is the University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Survey.
Okay.
That was the way that I sort of looked at the inflation situation going into 2021, right? And we know the Fed, obviously, was late. I started saying these guys are late in late 2020, early 2021. The reason that I thought the transitory thing was bogus was not because the Fed was inherently wrong in their assumptions. They weren't, actually. They were saying that, look, we're going to fix the transitory issues on supply chains and that will bring costs down, blah, 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 blah. That was true. That has occurred. Goods inflation is gone. It's essentially non-existent at this point. It's done a full roundabout. The difference was services, and it's because wages were starting to really build out. And then, of course, the Fed compounded the issue by raising rates very hard and adding housing into the mix. But when you look at where you started to see that inflation wasn't going to be a transitory thing was in that University of Michigan consumer confidence survey, because one thing that they do is they measure consumer inflation expectations. And since this entire story, since the beginning of 2021, what you saw was consumer confidence collapsing as inflation expectations were surging. And then, so you saw it early. You saw the Fed was not going to be able to sit around and do nothing, because consumers were saying, we are now behaving on the basis that inflation is killing the economy. And we're pulling back, and this is terrible, and we're suffering. You need to go out there and you need to go fix this now. And the Fed got around to it in June of that year and went, yeah, you're right. Okay. What you've been seeing since the beginning of 2022 has been the opposite. Consumer confidence has been steadily improving because inflation expectations in that same survey have been coming down. We just saw much better than expected retail sales numbers this week. Hmm. You keep getting these indications. Like, why is the U.S. economy doing so much better than elsewhere?
6%.
It's because the economy is 70-80% household consumption.
We sprayed down this entire economy with trillions of dollars of liquidity.
Consumption is holding up as the bottom line, and it's because consumer confidence has improved significantly over the past year and a half. It's certainly not lost on me in that same conversation that over the past, let's call it half a year, wages are growing faster than in inflation. So purchasing power is rising. And you can see that in the data that we get on personal consumption expenditure. Indeed, it has been trending higher since wages have been growing faster than inflation. So the consumer is in okay shape here. Wages growing faster than inflation gives you an opportunity for people's purchasing power to catch up to where prices have reset in the absolute sense.
Can I say something just real quick? It's not even a rebuttal. It's like an aside, because, sure, you know, I respect you and you've taught me a lot throughout the years. But on the issue of transitory, saying they were right, there's three things I want to say. First,
I'm not saying they were right. I'm saying they were half right.
I want to use their own words. So Powell said, I think it was back in 2021. So I think the word transitory has different meanings to different people. Powell told Senator Pat Toomey, Republican, mm-hmm, Pennsylvania. To many, it carries a time, a sense of short-lived. We tend to use it to mean that it wouldn't leave a permanent mark in the form of higher inflation. I think it's probably a good time to retire that word and try to explain.
He's right.
Hold on. Try to explain more clearly what we mean. At this very moment, there is some discussion about whether 2% is actually going to be the long-term inflation target, or whether it's going to be something, are they going to have to accept something like 2.5%? So in both definitions, whether it means short-lived or whether it means you have some additional scarring in the economy where you're forced to accept higher levels of inflation, both of those have a decent, the first was wrong, the second has the decent non-zero probability of also being wrong, meaning in his own words, wrong. By the way, in order to get to this point, if it's transitory, it means it'll sort of work its way out of the system. We are now at 5.25 in terms of our Fed funds rate, and we got there in record time in a way.
I agree with all of that.
Third point, Janet Yellen herself also said she regrets saying inflation.
No, I agree with all of that. What I mean, I agree with all of that.
I take issue when people.
Here's why I say that they were
sort of given the benefit of the doubt that he was right, because we're several years down the road. But it's like he was wrong. And in order to do anything about that transitory inflation, we had to go up to 5.25.
Here's why I'm saying that he was right. And they were right. Here's how I mean that. They were saying that inflation, because of these, that the reason we have inflation is these goods side disruptions, which are temporary, and when they close, the inflation supply will go
side,
away.
Supply side issues with the supply
right.
chains.
And on that, they were reason. Right. On that, they were right. But what they were wrong about is how much of that is the totality of inflation. And I was there in early 2021, looking at the consumer confidence data, looking at the jobs market data, going, of course it's not transitory. And you're going to have to hike rates. Not because you're wrong about the goods side, but because you're overstating how much of inflation is the goods side. And what you're not appreciating is the stickiness in labor markets, the importance of what's happening in consumer and in market expectations, and the importance of structural factors like deglobalization, which will make inflation structurally higher probably for the next however many decades. Mm-hmm. So, of course you have to hike. So yes, they were right that the goods part of this is transitory. That's what I mean. They were right. It was. What they're wrong about, or what they were wrong about, is how much of inflation was that. They thought it was okay. most of it, and they were wrong.
I see what you're doing. You're splitting inflation into, you're segmenting inflation.
Yes, and
you're
saying there's the transitory and the sticky. Yeah. They okay, over-indexed on how much of it was transitory versus sticky.
That's fair. Totally fair. We've actually That's had it. That conversation before, and we totally agree on that point. My good friend, I wanted a nice, clean, tight show. I thought maybe we'd get out of here in 35 minutes, but I should have known better. Every conversation with you, we take up every single precious minute or second, and I promise you, you always make it worth it. Thank you very much, Ilya Spivak, for joining me. It's our third conversation this week. I thought that there's not much in this and this orange or this lemon to squeeze, and I was entirely wrong. There's always something to learn with an hour conversation from Ilya. Ilya, if the people want more from you, either on social media or they want to watch you on the network here the remainder of this week or next week, where should they go?
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I am on Overtime Monday through Thursday. That's with Chris and Dylan. That's right after the Wall Street close. Right after that is Macro Money, which is my macro nerd show, where we unpack things like, will Japan intervene into the yen? That was today's show.
Oh, I gotta watch that.
And other nerdy things. I'm on with you here every Wednesday. I'm back on with you every Sunday with Tom for First Call at the APAC market open. I am on with Chris for Futures Power Hour on Friday. I am writing for the News and Insights portion of tastylive.com 4 days a week, and that's sort of the companion piece for Macro Money. First I write it, then I talk about it. Then I'm also opining on the platform formerly known as Twitter, because that's the only way that I will give any kind of credence to this ridiculous name change, at Ilya Spivak.
My good man, let's do this. Everybody, let's bring back the name Twitter. Call it whatever you want to. I'm not playing these games with these companies. All right, my friend, it was an honor and a pleasure. The next time I see you, I'll be on the other side of the world. I'm looking forward to these conversations every Wednesday, learning from you. If you weren't around when we made this announcement, from now on, we're gonna have this show is gonna have two parts to it. Tuesdays, Chris is going to be on. Wednesdays, Ilya is going to be on. What does that mean? That means we get to have some sort of running dialogue that we're having with each other and with the audience. And then Monday and Thursdays, I will, I'll hit that Rolodex and have on as many guests as we can. So we get this nice little mix of both internal point of views, running dialogue, and net new point of views from outside guests. And I'm hoping, we'll see. We'll do that for a while and see how it goes. If we like it, great. If not, we'll pivot. That's what we do around here. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Hit the like button on your way out of the door. Subscribe to the channel if you haven't already. Follow my good friend Ilya on Twitter. You can follow myself as well, at Victor Jones. The Owen Jones is zero because I like to be difficult. Wish me luck. Hopefully I'm not on a Boeing plane. I'll see you on the other end. Peace. Tomorrow's a replay, by the way. Peace.
Peace.
The content of this podcast is created, produced, and provided solely by Tasty Life, Inc. and does not represent the direct views or opinions of any of its affiliated companies. This content is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not, nor is it intended to be trading or investment advice or a recommendation that any security, futures contract, digital asset, other product, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any person. Trading securities, futures products, and digital assets involve risk and may result in a loss greater than the original amount invested. Tasty Live Inc., through its content, financial programming, or otherwise, does not provide investment or financial advice or make investment recommendations. The information provided may not be appropriate for all investors and is provided without respect to individual investor financial sophistication, financial situation, investing time horizon, or risk tolerance. Tasty Live Inc. is not a licensed financial advisor, registered investment advisor, registered broker-dealer, or registered